Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
This is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly look at the issues that matter to the residents of the San Joaquin Valley.
Hello and welcome to Valley Public Radio's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, we talk peaches with one of the nation's most acclaimed organic farmers, David Mas Masumoto, his wife Mercy, and daughter Nikiko. They're the authors of a new book of stories and recipes called The Perfect Peach. We'll also kick off a new segment on our program called Homegrown, a public radio book club focusing on books about the San Joaquin Valley. Stay tuned for information about how you can participate in that. That's coming up later in the show. But first, we turn our focus to the world of education. Suspensions and expulsions are a big problem in California's public schools. Last year, educators expelled over 350,000 students. That's one out of every 20. And students who are suspended are more likely to drop out. In an effort to address the problem, some school districts are looking to replace zero-tolerance policies with new approaches to discipline, including something called restorative justice. One of the state's largest districts, Fresno Unified, will launch a new discipline program featuring restorative justice concepts at the start of the new school year. But in the tiny Merced County community of La Grande, this alternative program is already working to reduce suspensions and expulsions and change the climate on campus. Valley Public Radio's Rebecca Plevin reports on what it means for student success.
It was a case of teenage boys being teenage boys that led Nathan Sheriff to spend an afternoon cleaning the locker room at La Grande High School.
Me and my friend were like messing around with each other's lockers, and I told him I peed on his locker, and I was just kidding, and then he actually peed on mine, so I punched him.
Sheriff and his friend, Isaiah Villalobos, might have been suspended at another school, but La Grande resolves conflicts through a disciplinary approach called restorative justice. Sheriff and Villalobos both received in-school suspension. Then, on a Wednesday in May, they slid on some latex gloves and prepared to make amends with each other and school custodian Miguel Puente.
The urinals, just spray it inside and out, and just wipe it down, disinfect it.
Scrubbing toilets, sinks, and showers forced the boys to realize the consequences of their actions.
To just send them home and suspend them, they're not really thinking about their actions or what they did and then who they affected.
Andre Griggs coordinates the restorative justice program at La Grande.
Them helping him clean up their locker, helping them clean up the floors and the toilets kind of give them an appreciation of what the custodians do every single day.
About 500 students attend La Grande High School. Still, this small school is helping to pioneer an alternative approach to classroom discipline that is being considered in much larger districts across the state. The concept is that students and staff benefit from discussing acts of misconduct, making them right, and finding ways to prevent them from happening again. At La Grande, a youth panel called the Justice League is an important part of the process.
What we do is when two kids are in an argument, we kind of just come together and we solve it. And I always mention the word student advocates because that's pretty much what we are. That's what we're here for. We're like lawyers for our classmates.
Recent graduate Brianna Biaggi was on the panel this year. She says the Justice League advocates for solutions.
We have them kind of summarize and talk about what happened in their perspective, and we go back and forth until everybody comes to sort of an understanding, and we all brainstorm and come together and think about what we can do to fix this problem now and prevent it from happening later on.
It's an alternative to traditional forms of punishment at schools. Javier Martinez is the principal at La Grande.
We were having, just as any other school, suspensions and expulsion rates that were, you know, for us, I consider high.
Before the restorative justice program, the school averaged around 50 suspensions a year and 15 expulsions. This year, there were just 10 suspensions and one expulsion. According to the Civil Rights Project at UCLA, traditional suspension increases a student's probability of dropping out. That's one reason Martinez has embraced restorative justice.
My job is to make sure that students graduate rather than expelling them.
Ron Clausen founded the Victim Offender Reconciliation Program of the Central Valley. Today, he's the director of restorative justice programs at Fresno Pacific University.
If students actually agree to, first of all, they recognize what happened, they acknowledge that, and then they repair the damage between them and they decide not to do it again, the likelihood of them doing it again is very low.
He's seen how restorative justice prevents young people from committing multiple offenses within the criminal justice system and schools.
In a punitive system, the assumption is that fear will change people. And in a restorative system, the assumption is that right relationships will change a person.
Earlier this year, Stephanie Rosas and a friend were caught twice ditching their internships at the Merced Mall.
Well, the consequences were our principal told us that we weren't going to be able to walk for the graduation ceremony, and at first we didn't really care.
But she says it was a big deal for their families.
Both of us are going to be the first people in our families to be able to walk in graduation, be able to receive that high school diploma, and it was really embarrassing for our families too.
They took their case to the Board of Trustees and the Justice League. They apologized and agreed to perform community service, including cleaning the cafeteria.
Right now with this, we can fix what we're doing and also getting our punishment, but also kind of still bringing a little bit of pride back in with our family and knowing, you know, we worked so hard to get this diploma and we're actually going to be able to do it. Even though we messed up, we can still fix it.
Beyond its impact on individual students, Principal Martinez says restorative justice has helped change the school culture.
Students are more eager to stop problems before they actually occur versus before they wanted to see that fight. Now they are preventing that from happening. They feel that they're part of this new system.
Restorative justice has earned a passing grade at LeGrand this year. And the school was recently awarded a grant to expand the student training and mentoring component of the program. Fresno Unified will implement restorative justice concepts at some schools in the coming school year. For Valley Public Radio, I'm Rebecca Plevin.
And Rebecca Plevin joins us now in studio to talk a little more about the restorative justice concept as it exists in LeGrand. Rebecca, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Jeff.
First of all, the two cases that you looked at today, I guess in the overall scheme of things, are probably rather minor. There's a lot of different types of discipline problems that can happen on campus, from things like the urination on the locker to something that's a lot more severe, bringing a knife to campus or a fight that causes a lot of injuries, things like that. How does restorative justice fit into the overall spectrum of discipline problems in a public school? Is it used for all of them, or are some still reserved for more traditional type of approaches of expulsion and things?
Right. The way I understand it is that you might not use restorative justice if, you know, a student brought like a gun to school and they were really going to pose a threat to students and teachers. I think restorative justice, people say it works really well in terms of conflicts between students and teachers, students and students. And you hear this concept a lot nowadays that students are getting suspended at very high rates for stuff like willful defiance. So where they're just not, maybe they're not complying with a teacher or administrator's orders, and it could just be not pulling up their pants or something. And students are getting suspended for that. And then they're going home and they're out of school and disconnected from school. And so the idea of restorative justice for those types of things is that you can repair that situation between people and maybe also address some of the underlying causes that caused that problem.
Now, you talked to a lot of students in LeGrand who were not featured in this report, and I'm curious to hear a little more of your insight into their thoughts about this program. Sometimes you hear students talk about suspensions almost like it's a vacation. I got suspended from school. I can play video games. I can go home. Are they as excited, I guess you could say, about having to go in front of the Justice League and have their peers evaluate them and give them some harsh criticism? What's the mood like on campus in that regard?
Right. So at LeGrand, this was the first year this program was implemented. So I think it's still pretty new and students are still learning about it and still asking questions about it. But the way I understand it is that the concept really holds students accountable. And so what I was hearing both from students and teachers is that students maybe weren't getting into those fights or maybe weren't doing the things that would cause them to go before that panel just because they might be held actually accountable for what they did.
Well, Rebecca, thank you so much for that insight and that report. She'll be joining us again later in our program to talk about our new Homegrown Book Club, which is a new feature on our program that's coming up later in our show. Rebecca, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Jeff.
The demands of the workplace and home life can make it hard to find time to be physically active. Many employers are incorporating healthy activities into the workplace, often using money as a motivator. But as Pauline Bartolone in Sacramento reports, the trend comes with concerns about who's paying for more health care.
Susan Southard walks 10 miles a week without taking her eyes off a computer screen.
The maximum speed is 2 miles, so I do the maximum.
Every day at 12 noon, Southard uses a treadmill desk for an hour at her office in El Dorado Hills. She adjusts the height of the desk, turns on the fan, and starts walking.
I've lost weight over the last couple years, about 40 pounds. And that's really without changing my eating habits.
The mileage she puts in on her walking work desk has helped her shed the pounds. She likes being able to work normally at her keyboard while getting a workout.
My doctor told me that I've gone from morbidly obese to just obese now.
Southard says she has more energy. She also has more money in her bank account. Her employer is the health insurer Blue Shield of California. It offers an average 18% discount on health premiums to employees who meet specific health goals. Bryce Williams of Blue Shield says treadmill desks are just one aspect of the company's workplace fitness and healthy eating initiatives.
The traditional model has been exercise 20 to 30 minutes a day, 3 to 5 days a week, et cetera, et cetera. And we've been trying that for 20 to 30 years.
Williams says anybody who is inclined to follow that regimen would have already done it.
What it really means is I have to come in early, go home late, skip my lunch, miss my kid's ball game. And if that's what we're up against, we always lose.
Blue Shield of California says its in-house health program may have brought millions of dollars in savings for the company and its employees.
When we started this, about 1 in 4 of our employees was hypertensive with documented high blood pressure, which is a pretty damning indictment of a healthcare organization, right? And now that number is 1 in 10.
The California health insurer is not the only large employer to join the workplace wellness trend.
As healthcare costs have steeply increased over the last decade or so, employers have really struggled with what to do.
Tom Perry of the Integrated Benefits Institute says for a while, employers responded to rising health costs by changing coverage to shift costs to employees.
But I think eventually employers have come to realize that the only real way to improve the economic burden of health care is to improve health.
But the impact of workplace wellness programs is questioned and controversial. Perry says it's hard to know how many California workplaces use the programs, and there's wide variation in what they look like. And he says it's also difficult to measure if they effectively reduce health costs.
You know, I think the evidence is spotty. There's evidence in some cases that shows it works. There's evidence in other cases that shows, well, I'm not so sure.
Critics of the trend are also concerned about fairness. They say workplace wellness programs may just be a way to shift health expenses onto people whose circumstances make it harder to be healthy. Democratic State Senator Bill Monning offered a bill this year that would have prohibited financial penalties.
For the 20-something young person, let's say a single young man who's every day punches out at 5 and goes to the gym, he may be in a very different position than a young mother with 3 kids who's maybe working part-time and has to take a bus after work to pick up children at daycare. They're not on a level playing field.
Monning and others say these programs are likely to flourish under the new federal health law. He says he supports the idea, but workplace wellness programs should reward participation, not force people to pay more if they have a pre-existing condition.
And these are good objectives. We just don't think they should be linked to premium payment penalty for those who aren't able to achieve those health outcomes.
Blue Shield of California says its employees can also get discounts for participation in programs like weight loss. They can also get a discount with a doctor's note excusing them. Pauline Bartolone in Sacramento.
You're listening to Valley Edition. For more news about health and wellness, visit our website, kvpr.org, and stay tuned in just a moment. Organic farmer David Masumoto, his wife Marcy, and daughter Nikiko, they join us to talk about their new book, The Perfect Peach, that's coming up next on Valley Edition. Without a doubt, one of the best parts of summer in the San Joaquin Valley has to be fresh stone fruit from valley orchards. Ripe, juicy, and delicious, the valley's peaches, plums, apricots, and nectarines are the envy of the rest of the country. And perhaps no one has done more to boost the profile of our local peaches, and in such a poetic way, than our guest today, Delray organic farmer and writer David Masumoto. He's a third-generation family farmer, a James Beard Award finalist, and this year was appointed by President Obama to the National Council on the Arts. He's also a member of the board of the James Irvine Foundation, which, in the interest of disclosure, is a supporter of this station. His 1995 book, Epitaph for a Peach, brought his work to a national audience and received a Julia Child Award. His most recent book, The Perfect Peach, combines both recipes and stories and truly reflects his family farm, as his wife Marcy and daughter Nikiko are co-authors. This lavishly illustrated book gives readers recipes for everything from prosciutto-wrapped peaches to peach galette. They all join us here today in our studio for Valley Edition. Moss, welcome.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be back.
And Marcy, thank you for joining us. And Nikiko, thanks so much for being here.
Love being here. Thank you.
Always a treat.
Moss, I'll start with you. The title of the book, The Perfect Peach, refers to so many different things. The first thing that came to my mind is there anything more perfect than a peach?
One of the challenges on our farm is that we always want to raise that perfect peach. It becomes a goal that we strive for every year. And it's a fun goal because this is a product of nature. So perfection isn't a static object. It involves sometimes the flavor, sometimes it's the juices. And this year, it involves recipes that Marcy and Nikiko had developed for this cookbook.
While I'm a big fan of peach pie and peach ice cream, for me, I've always thought it's been really hard to improve upon the flavor of the peach that's just picked ripe from the tree. Has that been a challenge in preparing this book to cook the recipes but avoid eating the peaches before they're actually in the recipe? That would be my challenge, I can tell you that.
There's a great division of labor that occurred in this cookbook. I don't cook well at all. So I handled the essays of the book where Marcy and Nikiko divided up the recipes, the 50 recipes that they came up with.
Part of the story of the perfect peach is in search of what is a perfect peach, and then how do you use that perfect peach in the kitchen? So it's kind of a combination of enjoying that peach that will burst with flavor in your mouth and juices dangle on your chin after the running down your cheeks. But the other part is, what can you do with them other than eating them out of hand?
Nikiko, you're the fourth generation on your farm now.
Yes.
What's your earliest memory of your family's produce, these beautiful peaches?
I don't remember my first peach because I say that I probably had it in the womb. But two of my earliest memories about harvest, when I could identify numbers, I was given the job of stamping our peach boxes. So I must have been 4 years old. And so when we started packing every summer, I would get this purple ink and these really old, worn stamps that we'd used for generations. And my job was to stamp each box. And somehow at the end of the day, I would always end up with this pink and purple ink all over my hands.
You've brought some peaches here with you today. Moss, I want to ask you, every year is different. You mentioned that in the book. What has this year's harvest been like so far? We're at the beginning of the season, but some varieties are already out there and already almost done.
It's been an early year because we've had a very, if you remember, in April, it was very warm. It felt like summer. And we also, of course, had a very, very dry year. So those elements caused the ripening to mature. We're probably about a week ahead of last year, which meant it's like I lost the week of work sometime in the month of May. It just disappeared. So we're frantically sprinting right now. But because of the warmth, I think the quality is just amazingly juicy this year. And so I'm finding the quality very, very good. Some fruit, one variety, the fruit was a little small this year. So we're trying to understand the dynamics of how to work with small fruit in the marketplace. The marketplace tends to reward big ones, and we tend to have small ones. So we're trying to, again, redefine that notion of what is perfection. And a perfect peach isn't always the biggest one or the reddest one. It's the one that we think we have has flavor. And that's what we want to do and instill that sense of memory with people when they eat their peaches.
You've been farming in an organic method for decades now. Tell us about why you made that decision and how has that changed over the years as organic has become such a big buzzword. But it's really more than just that word in your philosophy and approach.
Yeah, I began farming organically for a couple reasons. One was when I first came back to the farm, I was trying to figure out how can you survive as a small farmer. And when we sold into the conventional marketplace, we were just such a small player that we were just overwhelmed. And everything was based on production. And we didn't have that big of a farm. We have an 80-acre farm, and 25 acres are in peaches and nectarines. So how could we compete? So one method, one thought, one approach was if we farmed organically, it would be a way for us to differentiate our product. The other one, of course, was I did my undergraduate work at Berkeley. So I ran away from the farm, kind of got radical, but then came back to the farm, too. When I came back, I think I did bring some ideas and attitudes. And one was definitely to look at the land that we worked in through the lens of the environment and the ecology. And organic farming, for me, fit what we wanted to do on the farm because it was all about promoting life. And that life would then overlap. So when I got married, we had children, that was all part of the life of the farm. And organic farming for me is all about sustaining and promoting life.
I'd like to throw in there that as wife and mother, as we were contemplating what directions we were going to go with the farm, we had a young child. We live on the farm. We live 20 yards from our vineyards and our orchards. And the requirements for conventional farming are that you post signs, you know, with the crossbones when you've applied pesticides. And I'm thinking, how can I tell my 18-month-old toddler to stay out of the front yard because there have been chemicals applied? So to me, it just made sense, especially living in the environment, living on the farm, that we care for that environment and care for all of the life on the farm.
That 18-month-old toddler has since grown up, and she's with us today. Talk about what it's been like to work, obviously, on the farm together as a family, and now on this book together as a family.
Yeah.
Where'd you start, Nikiko?
Yeah, I grew up working, and to be honest, I really didn't know how special it was until I left. It was when I, following my dad, went to UC Berkeley, and I took an environmental studies class that I was able to put our farm in a larger context, in a global context, in a political context, and really understand the importance and the radical choice to farm organically. And since then, since I have grown, and I can say I'm an adult now, and we worked on this book together, I really felt really lucky. I felt I got to emerge as a peer with my parents through collaborating on this book, and I felt that was a very special experience to work as equals.
It's really tricky to work on a family farm because you're living together and you're working together and you're making decisions that are also for the long term too. So you try to combine all these together and you quickly realize if this is going to work or not. And so far it's working, and I think it will continue to work too. It brings out and amplifies all the dynamics in a relationship for good and bad at the same time. And even working on this cookbook, it was very clear early on that I would have nothing to do with the recipes. and it was fascinating to watch Nikiko and Marcy develop recipes and work together as a mother and a daughter and also as peers too.
It was a real pleasure to work with Nikiko because, of course, she learned to cook with me from early on. And so, you know, I went from the teacher to the peer in a sense. And it was a joy to learn how the difference in styles that each of us had, what we brought to the kitchen, basically. And it's probably defined by our generation, by our age, by our era, kind of enlightenment and what influenced us more. So what I brought to the cookbook the majority of the time were the dessert recipes, the traditional, the pies, the cobblers, the crisps, as well as the section on most of the section on preserving food, because that was something that was really important to me. And I fear the loss of that skill to keep good fruit to enjoy year-round. And Nikiko brought a completely different perspective, a new, fresh California cuisine style of cooking, I believe.
Well, I didn't have the depth and wealth of knowledge that my mom had, so I had to really have a wild approach, at least wild for me. And so I did a lot of thinking and imagining the wildest combinations I could possibly come up with. And some of the results were things like peach gazpacho. That recipe, I literally went into our kitchen with a huge basket of vegetables and just locked myself in there until I came up with something. One of the recipes from that day didn't work, but the peach gazpacho, I love it. I think it did. So I think maybe in a way our age difference really was is a strength, because my newness meant I had to innovate.
If you just joined us today on Valley Edition, our guests are the Masumoto family, the authors of the new cookbook called The Perfect Peach. It's really more than just a cookbook, though. It has recipes and stories from the Masumoto family farm, Marcy, Nikiko, and David Mas Masumoto. They have a number of events coming up celebrating this book, which we'll talk about in a little bit. And we'll also hear some excerpts from those stories in just a moment. Before we get to that, though, I've noticed in the book, Moss, that there's many references to peaches in human terms, as if the peaches and the varieties are people. And I'm wondering, what is it about the peach and these peaches in particular that inspires that connection?
Well, I think one thing we forget, that food is alive. I mean, especially peaches. It comes from something that's alive. It's not a commodity and it's not a product. So once you start thinking of it in that different frame, you develop a relationship with it. And especially as a farmer and a family farmer, we develop relationships with our peaches. We get to know how they grow, what weather they like, the dirt that they like, and we develop those kind of personal relationships, and that's exactly what we want. We want to personalize our produce because we commit our passion to it, and we hope that that passion is expressed through flavor and the juices and the nectar and the aroma of our peaches. So the idea of personifying it is to bring and put life back into food, and not only as a peach, but also Marcy and Nikiko, with their recipes, they wanted to put that life back into a recipe. So that's why all the recipes have pretty extensive head notes, as they call it. And a head note is that beginning paragraph to a recipe. It tells the backstory. In a way, it's a very short story that has to capture all the meaning of the recipe in about maybe 70 words. It's actually, as a writer, I looked at that and I go, I would have a tough time writing a head note, because I'd want to start expanding it. Maybe it'd be like 4 pages of a head note before you got to the recipe. So it was a real challenge watching them and witnessing them as they wanted to put their own personality into that recipe and express it as this little literary gem of a short story to begin each recipe.
Nikiko, eating a peach is an amazing experience. Some would say a sensual experience. The flesh, the aroma, the juice from the peach. I'd like to hear your thoughts on that relationship between the human experience and the peach.
Yeah, when I think about eating a peach fresh off the tree, what's interesting is I think about my own individual body. But when I think about cooking, I think about a communal experience. And I think that the communal experience is actually always there, even if we are eating an individual peach by ourselves. But there's something so magical and something I believe that's so sacred about both farming and cooking, because we are preparing something that is going to enter someone else's body. It's going to nourish their body. I mean, it's a very intimate experience. And I just love, I show my love for people by cooking for them. And I show my love for the earth by farming. And it has given me so much as a young person, as a young farmer.
One of the elements, too, about working with food, and we work with it day and night. It's out in the fields, but yet it's in our house. It's on our tables. It's all about that human element. And you're absolutely right in framing it as part of this humanity that we live. And that humanity extends also to like how we want to hopefully treat our workers and what we do with the extra peaches that we have, because we donate them to a couple like Heinz Hospice gets a lot of our peaches just to give away, because it's part of that other gift economy that's part of the work that we do too. And it's all part of that almost sacredness that we have with our fruits.
Marcy Nikiko and David Moss Masumoto are our guests today on our program. And this book is out this month by 10 Speed Press. There's a number of events coming up to celebrate it. But before we get to talking about those events, I'd like to ask all three of you to read some passages, because this is more than just a traditional cookbook. There's some great stories, and anyone who's a fan of the three of you will definitely enjoy the prose in this book as well. Moss, let's start with you, and what selection do you have for us today?
I'm going to read a short passage from an essay called Sweat. And the reason why I wrote this and put it in the cookbook is I wanted people to know that when they're eating a wonderful peach, making a recipe with a peach, they understood the sweat and the work that's involved with it. So here's this section about sweat. I'm not sure you understand sweat. Out on the farm, I've tasted sweat, a salty, tangy flavor as it drips down my temples, beads on my upper lip, and slips across my cheeks. Farm work makes me sweat. It first appears on my chest, seeping through my pores, subtle and silent, unannounced, on bare skin. Sweat defines the character of our farm. I think of sweat as clean and honest. Sweat reminds me of limits. Summer work in 100-degree heat, hellishly hot. The work beats me. I take short breaths, saving energy, feeling my heart race, the veins and arteries pulsating. I want to quit. Not worth it. Sweating is cutting years off my life, a drip off my chin, my nose, draining life away. Sacrifice years for a peach harvest. The work beats me again and again. Start out young. After a few years of sweat, you suddenly discover you're old. I stagger home and collapse. My children see me. They worry. Something wrong, Dad? Are you okay? They ask. My eyes stay shut. I shake my head. This farm's gonna kill me. They stand silently. They know I'm telling the truth. Sweat and peaches.
David Moss Masumoto reading from his new book, The Perfect Peach, a piece titled Sweat. Moss, these peaches, they are really a part of you and a part of your family. What's it like seeing them go across the country to some of the finest restaurants in the world and right here at home? It's a little part of you, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And there's a sense of satisfaction, of contentment, of relief to be able to share what we do and hopefully find homes for all these peaches and all this fruit. And at the same time, make that connection and dissolve that division between rural and urban, city and country, and have that food be the thing that connective tissue between people, so that they understand that food doesn't just come from a grocery store. It comes from people working the land, and add that human element to the foods that we eat.
Marcy, you have a passage as well that you'd like to read. Tell us about this one.
Yes, I'd like to read an excerpt from the chapter called Preserving Peaches Starts Here. And I had mentioned earlier that food preservation is a passion of mine, so I'd like to share this with you. I fear the art of preserving food in the home kitchen is near extinction, and I am happy to share with you, my fellow peach lovers, what has become intuitive for me. The truth about preserving foods for me is that while nothing is better than a high-quality fresh product, good preserved foods are far better than poor-quality off-season, not-so-fresh products. Although consumers have allowed the food industry to do most of the work in this era, The quality of the products and the options have become extremely limited in the marketplace. For example, it can be difficult to find peach jam in our local supermarket, and commercial frozen peaches are beautiful but often lack deep flavor. So if you have access to great quality fresh peaches, I believe you're better off bringing home a lot of them and putting in a little time preserving them, canning, jamming, freezing, drying, to enjoy at a later date.
Again, Marcy Masumoto reading from the new book, The Perfect Peach. Speaking of preservation, Moss, it's not just preserving peaches for the season. It's also preserving these varieties, some of which are becoming quite rare. Talk a little about that.
One of the challenges we faced was that I wanted great tasting peaches. The whole industry went through a metamorphosis where they began to grow peaches that looked good, were bigger, were redder, and had shelf life. Older varieties lacked those qualities, and they were suddenly gone. All of our varieties tend to have a lot of fuzz because that's part of that old tradition. When they bred away some of those things, I think they accidentally bred away flavor. So what we set out on a crusade was to keep these things, to keep this flavor, to keep this memory alive in people. And we're so very fortunate that the timing worked as the organic marketplace started to expand, as, you know, the local market, the idea of local mentalities, the culture of food started to expand. We were right there, and our peaches and our farm fit that.
One of the things that Nikiko and I tried to illustrate in the book is there's a section called the Peach Primer, and we purposefully included explanations to the peach lover, to the cook, to the reader, as to how do you select a peach? What is a good peach? What's the difference between a yellow flesh peach and a white flesh peach? How do you store them? How do you use them? How do you know when they're ripe? What, you know, do you want a really soft peach for a certain dish or a firmer peach? And so part of this book is also trying to educate our readers all about peaches that I think many people have lost. I mean, generations ago, when we had access to our aunt and uncle or our grandparents that lived on a farm, people had the understanding of the seasonality of food and the qualities of food. And today, I think many of our consumers don't have that opportunity. So we're trying to share that knowledge, that history, that experience through our book with our readers.
Nikiko, speaking of generations, you're the fourth generation on this family farm. You're the Generation Y representative here. Food culture has become such a big thing, a big trend beyond just the food world. It's become a part of popular culture, and younger people are exploring food in different ways. You have publications like Modern Farmer magazine that are out now and so many different things. Talk about what something like this, what your farm means, not just to you, but to your generation, and the idea of sustainable produce, organic produce, and putting something like flavor over size and color and all of the things that we traditionally have marketed at us in the supermarket. What does that mean to you as a member of your generation?
Yeah, I think that right now there's a resurgence, there's a revival going on in young people, with young people and young communities about food and farming. And you see a lot of young people wanting to resuscitate that connection directly with the land. And I'm really invigorated by that. At the same time, I think one of the goals of our book is to tell a whole story of farming, not just the romantic rock star farmer side of farming, but the real side of farming, the farming that involves questions about uncertainty, how can we do this, questions about hard work, questions about how to live and work with family. And that's one of my hopes, is that within the young people movement and our renewed sense of attention to food, that we're not just cherry picking the privilege story, the story of the fine dining, but we're also really understanding the policy implications, the implications for the environment and our own sustainability on the ground as people.
Nikiko, you have a selection you'd like to read as well. Tell us about this.
Yeah, I have prepared the head note to one of my recipes. It's the head note for peach day pickles. And when my mom and I designed the recipes, we really wanted to take advantage of the head notes as a space to tell the backstory of the recipes and to really give a larger context for our work. So this particular head note is about my relationship with our family legacy. Peach day pickles. In 2011, I took my first trip to Japan with my mom, dad, and brother. We visited relatives in the small village of Takamura in Kumamoto Prefecture, where one of my great-grandmothers was born and spent her childhood. Driving from the train station to the family farmhouse, I looked out the window to see a flat, sweeping basin of cultivated land under the protective gaze of distant mountains. I felt at home. The scene looked so familiar to the view of our farm in the Central Valley, bordered by the towering Sierra Nevada. Many years ago, as my oba-san, great-grandmother, worked on the same land that I work today, I wonder if she looked up at the Sierra and thought for a second that she, too, was home. But she lived and toiled in these fields when anti-Asian racism was legalized in the early 20th century by the California Alien Land Laws of 1913 and 1920 that prohibited Asian immigrants from owning land in the state. Asians were not wanted, not welcomed. And yet, here I am, a fourth-generation Japanese-American, and I call this place home. The roots of this recipe come from tsunomono, a lightly pickled Japanese cucumber salad I grew up eating. I wish I could share it with my oba-san. I wonder if her spirit is still in these fields, imagining that she is home.
Nikiko Masumoto reading from the book The Perfect Peach. It's out now on 10-Speed Press. Nikiko, you could have left the farm. You did leave the farm, but you didn't have to return, is my point. What made you make that decision? And you talked about having a greater appreciation for it after you left. Talk about that decision a little more, because your peers are off all over the world. You're back at home. And I gather you're happy with that decision.
Yes. Yes. It wasn't an easy decision to make, and it hasn't been easy. It's been full of challenge. But I really think that's where the richness comes from. I mean, as a young person growing up here, I really felt like the Central Valley was confining to me on lots of different levels. And in many ways, I really needed to leave. I needed to leave to grow up. I needed to leave to mature, to put our valley in a different perspective. And when I came back, I found right here at home the values and the life that I wanted to live. I wanted to live and still do a radical life. And what I mean by radical is of or from the roots. I want to live rooted. I want to live in a place where my resilience is tested, not because it's easy to come back here, but because it's hard. And that's what draws me back here. I just would not be anywhere else. I champion people finding their own destiny, and I just feel really lucky that I found mine here.
It wasn't the piles of money that was waiting for you on the farm? I'm shocked.
I think it was mom and dad that she wanted to come back to.
Maybe mom. I don't know about all the hard work that she has to do, but okay.
Fascinating indeed, and a great family story, a great valley story, and it's all in this new book, The Perfect Peach, Recipes and Stories from the Masumoto Family Farm by Marcy Nikiko and David Masumoto. The book is available at masumoto.com, and I'm sure wherever fine books are sold, but you have a number of events coming up this week that showcase the book and also have an opportunity for folks to get to meet you, to get to hear some excerpts in person from the book, and also, I imagine, taste some of the peaches. Nikiko.
Yeah, we have designed a whole peach week trying to invite people out in various different formats. Tonight, I'm going to be at Fresno Brewing Company on the Fulton Mall in downtown at 7 p.m., and I'm just going to be, it's going to be a casual event. People can come and talk to me. We'll have some tastes of peaches there, and of course, the book available. And I'm just really looking forward to hearing what resonates with people, what is their perfect peach. And we also have some other events coming up. On Thursday, we are going to be giving the program at Respite by the River, a program of the San Joaquin River Parkway. And we'll be having a reading at 7 p.m. And everyone's invited. It's free, open to everyone to come earlier if you'd like with a picnic and lawn chair. And then at 7, we'll be showcasing more of the literary side of the book with a performance of all three of our voices. And then on Friday, for everybody who's been dying to taste our peaches, we are going to be having a meet and eat peach pickup at Dusty Buns Bistro. We love Dusty Buns. Our peaches will be on the menu, and we'll also be there. You can pre-order a flat of peaches that we will hand-pick and pack for you that week. So that'll be on Friday.
And the books will be there that night, too.
Sounds very exciting, and of course, you can get all of that information and more online at masumoto.com. Before we go, I want to go around the table here and ask you your perfect peach or your favorite peach, your favorite variety. Nikiko, start with you.
Always my initial thought of a perfect peach is warm from the sun right off the tree. That's the best perfect peach for me. My favorite variety, that's like choosing my favorite parent. It's impossible. But I will say right now, this season, the Spring Lady, our early variety, really, really captured my heart. It was the best I think it's ever been.
Moss?
We have 48-year-old peach trees on our farm and about 3 acres of a variety called Suncrest. And it's the variety that I wrote about in Epitaph for a Peach. So it's always been my favorite. It's the trees that I planted alongside of my father. And whenever I go in that orchard, I could feel his spirit walking with me. And that emotion, I hope, resonates in the flavor of those peaches.
Marcy?
For me, the perfect peach is one that explodes with flavor when you bite into it. It has just the right balance of sweetness versus acidity, and you can cook with it. So my favorite variety would probably be the Alberta, because it holds up very beautifully under heat, you know, in a pie, a cobbler, canning, whatever you're going to do with it, warm.
It's a delicious part of summer, and it wouldn't be complete without peaches and stone fruit from the Masumoto family farm. Joining us in our studio today, our guests have been Marcy, Nikiko, and David Moss Masumoto, authors of the new book, The Perfect Peach, Recipes and Stories from the Masumoto Family Farm. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. My name is Joe Moore. It's not every day that we debut a new segment on our program. I guess you could say we're doing that today. Actually, we're sort of previewing a new segment that'll be a recurring feature on future editions of Valley Edition. Not every week, but several times a year, we will have a launch of our new series called Homegrown. It's a virtual book club, a radio book club, or even better yet, a public radio book club. Here to tell us more about that is Valley Public Radio's own Rebecca Plevin. Rebecca, welcome back.
Thank you.
How did the idea for this series come about, and what's the concept behind it?
So it came about because I moved to Fresno about 4.5 years ago, and I experienced a lot of culture shock coming here from an urban part of the East Coast, and it was really a new experience for me. And to better understand this region, I started reading about the Valley. And I felt like when I read books about the Valley, it opened up a window into this new place I was living. And one of the very first books I read was called The Spirit Catches You and You Fall Down. And it's about a Hmong family in Merced, and one of their daughters starts having seizures when she's 3 months old. And the book sort of talks about the clash between the family's beliefs and Western medical beliefs.
And this series is going to be looking at books that, again, are about the Valley, not necessarily by Valley writers, though. And that's the case with Anne Fadiman, the author of this book, as well. this is going to be something that is also an opportunity for listeners to participate in as well.
Absolutely. So as I mentioned, our first book for this book club is going to be The Spirit Catches You and You Fall Down by Anne Fadiman. And we encourage everyone to go out and either buy the book or get it from the library or download it onto your e-reader of choice. Read the book in the next couple of weeks. Or if you've already read it, awesome. Go back through your copy and just remind yourself about it. And then we will be encouraging our listeners to get in touch with us either, you know, through email, through social media, or call in the day of the program. And, you know, we'll talk about your questions and we'll have a really rich discussion about this book.
So in a couple of weeks, we'll be back on the air. Rebecca will be back on the air and have an interview with the author, talk about the experience of writing this book and what has changed, what she's learned. And then we'll also have a panel discussion, a live segment with all of you and some other guests in studio. And that'll be a great opportunity to share some of the thoughts that our listeners and readers and folks on the website, social media have about this book and so much more. So it should be really interesting. Rebecca, tell me a little more. You've reported on this issue of the divide between different cultures and the Western medical tradition that we have, specifically in the need for translators for Southeast Asian immigrants and other communities in the hospitals, in the clinics throughout the valley. How does this book relate to that world?
Right. So when this book came out, or at least when you read the first chapters of the book, it talks about how this family would go to the hospital in Merced. And at that point, there weren't medical interpreters. Maybe if the family couldn't communicate with the doctors might pull in a janitor or, you know, or they'd have a 9-year-old child translate. So there weren't yet those medical interpreters that we have today. Today we do have some of those, but they still face challenges. I did a story a couple weeks ago about Hmong medical interpreters in Merced and how there's even conditions today that don't really have names in the Hmong tradition. So they had to sort of develop names for these conditions. You know, the one that stuck out to me was the term diabetes didn't have a name in the Hmong tradition, so they call it here. They translate it as sweet blood. So the book really touches on a lot of these themes. And the way I understand it, this book is actually taught in many medical schools now to talk about cultural competency in medicine.
So this is an opportunity for listeners to be involved and share their comments with us on the station. This is just the first installment of this as well. I understand we're already looking at some other books. What types of books are you looking for, though? Talk about that a little more as the person who's sort of spearheading this effort.
Yes. So we will be looking for books that are about the San Joaquin Valley and about different communities in the valley. I've talked about maybe the history of the valley. And so again, like you mentioned, it's not authors just from the valley, but really books that give us a window into the culture here. We've talked about maybe looking at books about the Sierra Nevada or other issues here in the valley.
Well, that's very exciting, and we're looking forward to it coming up in a couple of weeks on our program, so stay tuned. We'll have an interview with Anne Fadiman again. Tell us the name of the book and the information about it.
It's called The Spirit Catches You and You Fall Down.
And its author?
Anne Fadiman.
And it's about a Hmong child, American doctors, and the collision of two cultures. Fascinating book, and it's set in Merced, as you said.
Absolutely.
Very interesting. We're looking forward to that. And Rebecca will be back in a couple weeks and tell us more about the launch of that brand new series called Homegrown, our book club. You can find out more information online at kvpr.org. Each spring, district offices and school boards decide who will lead their schools for the following academic year. Many schools will receive new principals. In this edition of Valley Public Radio's commentary series, The Moral Is, Dr. Jack Benega of Fresno State School of Education writes that often such important decisions have little research to back them up.
If you have children or grandchildren in our public schools, you're apt to be surprised when they return to school next August. Many of us can expect to find our children's school headed by new leadership. Indeed, up to 20% of the schools in the Central Valley can be expected to have new principals when children come back to school after summer vacation. Some of these changes are to be expected. There are principals who retire after long and productive careers. Others who did not meet expectations are transferred. Still others applied for and received offers from neighboring districts. But a substantial number of excellent proven school leaders will have been laterally moved to lesser performing schools within their districts because of a sense that if they can turn around one school, they can do the same in the next. It's gotten to be a truism in education, because it is true, that an effective principal is a necessary precondition for a school to be effective. Decades ago, a U.S. Senate Committee on Equal Educational Opportunity concluded that the principal's leadership sets the tone of the school. If the school is a vibrant, innovative, child-centered place where students are performing to the best of their ability, stated the report, one can almost always point to the principal's leadership. So, it's not surprising that school districts are always on the search for dynamic new leaders. Many attempt to identify teachers with leadership potential and shepherd that potential through grow-your-own educational programs. That makes sense. But moving effective principals from well-run and achieving schools to schools with substantial problems and expecting those new principals to turn around those schools quickly is an unproven strategy for school success and may even be counterproductive. Moving principals who have been effective in one school to another more troublesome school often leaves those former schools unprepared to continue on their improvement path, while presenting a new set of problems in the new school, with the incoming principal viewed unrealistically as either a threat or a savior. The fact is that across America, principal turnover is high, with very little research to back up those important decisions. Up to one-third of all principals have less than 4 years in that leadership role. This trend suggests that decision makers are not very good at predicting which school leadership change will produce the best results. In reality, we know very little about the effect of high principal turnover on program sustainability. Perhaps a good rule of thumb, therefore, is to leave effective principals in place to continue to work their magic, while simultaneously supporting new school leaders with the resources to optimize their potential. This will result in fewer surprises for us, but more consistency for our children. And that may be a good thing. For The Moral Is, this is Jacques Benninga.
The commentary series The Moral Is was produced by Valley Public Radio in association with the Bonner Center for Character Education at California State University, Fresno. The opinions expressed are those of the writer and not necessarily Valley Public Radio. Send us your comments with an email. The address is talk@kvpr.org.
And that's all for today's Valley Edition. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kvpr.org. We also have a special video from the Masumotos about the sound of the perfect peach. See it on our website, kvpr.org. As always, we welcome your comments and suggestions. You can email us, talk@kvpr.org, and follow us on Twitter, the station account, @kvpr, and also @Valley Edition online. For audio engineer Marv Allen, production and operations manager Don Weaver, and Valley Edition producer Ezra Romero, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.